It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. On the program today, what the new year might bring to this economy of ours. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today. This one is the 18th of December. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. There were some comings and goings in a couple of the big stock indexes we talk about a lot on this program. The NASDAQ, heavy, as you know, on tech stocks, swapped five companies into its mix, including DoorDash. The S&P 500 made three changes, among them adding Uber. As Marketplace's Savannah Marr explains, the shakeups are all part of a quarterly rebalancing that the indices do that drive a whole lot of investing choices.
Stock indexes help us get a quick read on how publicly traded corporations as a whole are doing, says Paolo Pasquarello, a professor of finance at the University of Michigan.
Think of it as a gauge or a thermometer of the health of markets at any point in time.
Based on how dozens or hundreds of selected companies are performing. Sam Stovall with CFRA Research says diversification is the point. But recently, the major indexes have gotten more concentrated, with a handful of large companies weighted a little too heavily.
What these indexes do is say, okay, let's avoid or reduce this concentration risk by rebalancing, trimming.
If you have money in an index fund, these changes likely mean your investment is getting reshuffled, says Winnie Caesar with Credit Sites.
You have a portfolio of companies that is attempting to just replicate whatever that index is.
And little by little, that has become basically what the vast majority of us do on a daily basis.
Rather than betting on individual stocks, says Paolo Pasquarello at the University of Michigan. And he says there's a reason Americans have taken to this style of investing over the last few decades.
Beating the market, doing better than index investing is extremely difficult.
Funds that reflect stock indexes are cheaper to invest in. They offer better returns. He says it's hard to argue with that. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
As you've no doubt heard, all three major indices. Anyway, they're finishing the year way above where they started. Also, by the way, way above where it was as recently as, Friday. Ticker symbol X, U.S. Steel, which, assuming the deal closes, will become a wholly owned subsidiary of Nippon Steel. Shares up 26% today on a $14 billion buyout offer. Details on that and all the rest of it when we do the numbers. This next item is not perhaps on everybody's list of things to think about as the new year approaches, but it is literally our job around here. What do you suppose is 2024 in the workplace going to look like? Because both employers and employees seem to be just a bit wary. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams made some calls today to see what people are expecting.
There are some headline issues likely to shape the workplace in 2024. The continuing adoption of new AI tools, the stabilization of hybrid and remote work policies. Also on the radar for Ben Wiggert, Director of Research and Strategy for Workplace Management at Gallup.
We've seen a substantial drop in people's connection to their employer over the last couple of years. So we worry that if organizations don't lean into their organizational culture right now, that drop could continue.
A lot of that is due to workplace stress, with more than half of employees Gallup surveyed in the U.S. and Canada reporting feeling a lot of stress the previous day. Johnny Taylor Jr. is the president and CEO of SHRM, the Society for Human Resource Management. He says another stressful thing coming to the workplace in 2024, the election.
45% of U.S. workers say they've experienced political disagreements in the workplace. And a quarter have said they personally experienced differential treatment, so discrimination, because of their political views or affiliation.
This kind of workplace incivility can reduce worker productivity by more than 35%, says Christine Porath, who teaches at the University of North Carolina's Kenan Flagler Business School.
So it hijacks their attention, their focus, they're far less creative, and even witnesses are three times less likely to help anyone.
And not just in the office setting. Porath says frontline workers, like folks in customer service or healthcare, really get it bad. And it's getting worse. She says in 2005, nearly half of employees reported they were treated rudely once a month.
And in 2022, it was 76% of employees reporting that they were treated rudely at least one time a month.
So if you're looking for a New Year's resolution, don't be a jerk at work or to workers. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This has been a banner year for movies. Some movies. Barbie grossed more than $1.4 billion worldwide. Oppenheimer almost $1 billion. Some other would-be box office contenders, though, didn't quite live up to the hype. The Marvels had the worst box office debut of any Marvel movie to date, which, as you may know, Marvel movies, that's a very long list. So, why? Joanna Robinson, author, by the way, of MCU, The Reign of Marvel Studios, has some thoughts. Joanna, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What has happened to the tentpoles? Let me just name them, right? We had the latest Indiana Jones movie. We had Mission Impossible. We had, oh, by the way, The Marvels, which did not do what they were supposed to do at the box office. What's going on?
There's a couple things going on, a couple factors at play. I mean, first and foremost, I think we still need to think about how fresh we are off the pandemic in terms of people feeling like they are used to or safe to return to theaters. That's still on people's minds. I think one thing we need to look at with what did work to help us understand what didn't work is the undeniable sensation of the year cinematically is Barbenheimer, right? Barbie and Oppenheimer, where it's not just I'm going to see Barbie because that looks like a fun movie. I'm going to see Barbie so I can dress up in pink with my friends or do the Barbenheimer event in one day and tweet about it or make a TikTok about it. And all of a sudden, the idea of going to the cinema doesn't become this sort of sitting quietly in the dark experience anymore. And that's been happening for years, that people just keep their phones on in the movie theater, et cetera. But it becomes this sort of, you know, social event, mix and mingle event. And I think that also has something to do with the pandemic. People feeling so isolated for so long, they want to go out and connect with other people.
Do you think this changes the way, and look, Hollywood is a slow-moving beast, right? But do you think this changes the way they're going to approach selling their movies? Because, you know, I'm sick and tired of having to watch 42 Marvel Universe movies to figure out what's going on in the next one.
Right. The idea that there's homework that comes specifically with a Marvel movie.
Right.
Yeah. It's funny when you think about something like Marvel. the idea of an interconnected universe, the story just is connected to all the other stories and it goes ever on, was sort of heralded as their big innovation. But now they're seeing in the aftermath of that, that people are feeling a little tired, are feeling like there's a lot of homework. And so what we are getting next year in 2024, you say it's a slow moving machine, but we're only getting one Marvel movie next year. And so there will be this respite. And they are very much in a space of trying to recoup, retrench, and figure out how to go forward in a way that is friendly to newcomers as much as it's friendly to the diehard comic book nerds.
Well, thank goodness for small favors that they're giving us a break on all of that. But let me ask a variation of what you were just talking about.
Yeah.
So Marvel and Indiana Jones and all the Star Wars, right? They were all germinated in a single element of IP, right, of intellectual property. And then Disney and all the rest of them just took that and exploded it. And right. Yes, Barbie was IP and Oppenheimer came out of a book and also real life, you know, all of that jazz. And I guess my question is, do you think audiences are sick and tired of hearing variations of the same story with slightly different characters and are looking for something new?
We should say that there were a few hits this year. Guardians of the Galaxy 3, a Marvel movie, is one of the top movies of the year. Across the Spider-Verse, a Spider-Man movie was one of the top movies of the year. Super Mario, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, like these are all properties we know, properties we've seen before. So I think there are ways to do it that feel fresh and exciting for the audiences. But I think certainly Marvel, and I would say Warner Brothers and their DC films had a worse year than Marvel, given what happened with The Flash or their film The Blue Beetle that you may not even heard of. It sort of came with such a whimper.
I saw it and I liked it, actually.
I liked it, too. Right. And I think it's getting new life on HBO Max. I think a lot of people are catching up with it now that it is on a streaming platform. But I think you can no longer, you know, slap a cape and a pair of tights on a character. They don't really do that, but if they did, and just assume that people are going to line up. That is no longer an obvious gimme with audiences. And if you are sitting at home with your massive TV screen and your crisp surround sound and your comfortable chairs and you say, what can the theater going experience really give to me?
Right.
I don't know that, you know, Marvel can assume that they have quite the juice to get people to go in the same way that they enjoyed for a decade.
She knows what she's talking about. She wrote a book on the topic. Joanna Robinson. The book is called MCU, The Reign of Marvel Studios. Joanna, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time and your insights.
Thanks for having me.
All right, not that we're going to take out the movie industry, but if you miss something on the air, we've got a podcast, you know. Platform of your choice or marketplace.org. You can get it in both places. Coming up.
Financially, it didn't make sense, so I ended up going a very different route.
Yeah, if I had a nickel for every time that happened, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go on this Monday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 86 one-hundredths of a point. Decimal points matter. People will call that flat, right? 37,306. The NASDAQ rose 90 points, 0.6%, finished at 14,904. The S&P 500 up 21 points, 0.5%, 47.40. Just had a conversation about the movie business and why some would-be blockbusters, are just not. Well, Disney, which also owns Marvel, lost 0.6% today. AMC Entertainment Holdings up 1.4%. Trevor Milton, he's the founder of Nikola, the electric and hydrogen-powered truck company, was sentenced to 4 years in prison for defrauding investors. Nikola slowed 9.6% today. Competitor Rivian sped up about 4.25%. Apple has stopped the sale of some Apple Watch models in the United States, the Series 9 and Ultra 2. It's about a patent dispute with the medical device company Masimo over a feature that measures blood oxygen. Apple down 0.9%. Masimo gained 0.3%. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note up 3.93%. You're listening to Marketplace. You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Lest you think the week before Christmas will be devoid of big economic news, well, it will not. A couple of real estate data points tomorrow and Wednesday. The final update on third quarter economic growth on Thursday. And then on Friday, the biggie, the personal consumption expenditures index, known far and wide as the Federal Reserve's favorite way to measure inflation. Odds are that it's going to be flat-ish month to month, probably around 3% year on year, which, given that inflation was 9.1% annually back in the middle of 2022, 3% is pretty good. The catch is that for consumers, it's not that overall prices have come down. They're just not getting more expensive as quickly as they used to. But that is actually the plan. On the Econ 101 beat today is Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall.
The last year has been a period of disinflation for the U.S., not deflation. The Conference Board's Dana Peterson explains the difference.
Disinflation means that prices are not rising as quickly now as they were in the past.
Whereas deflation means
prices are actually falling.
Bank of America economist Stephen Juneau compares it to driving a car.
Disinflation would be if you slow down, but you're still, you know, moving forward, right? So you're still driving. Deflation, on the other hand, would be as if you were going in reverse.
And inflation very rarely moves in reverse, except in bad economic times like the Great Recession. And sure, during deflation, you may see your grocery bill go down, but Fordham University economist Patricia Gomez-Gonzalez says that's not the whole story.
People might postpone certain purchases. You might say, you know what, I'll buy a fridge in a few more months when it's even going to get cheaper, no? And that's a very tricky spiral to be in. No?
Deflation slows consumer spending and can lead to layoffs. That's why the Fed wants some inflation at a nice and slow 2%. Texas A&M's Tatevik Sekposian has another car-related analogy.
Inflation is like the grease that helps the economy run a little bit smoother. If you think about business owners, like if they actually expect prices to go up, they would actually invest a bit more in their business, hire more people.
Of course, that doesn't mean consumers have been immune to the sting of elevated inflation over the past few years. Stephen Juneau again.
We're not that far removed from 2019. It's only been a short period of time. And we all notice, you know, that prices have increased pretty dramatically, you know, up around 20% in aggregate.
But wages are catching up, which is a good sign for the American consumer. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
The International Air Transport Association figures that 4.7 billion people are going to get on planes next year, more by a lot than the record high of 4.5 billion set in 2019. To meet that demand, obviously, the airline industry is going to need pilots, lots of them. So if aviation is your thing, now might not be a bad time. That's the setup for today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Adam Kephart. I live in Poulsbo, Washington, and work in Seattle, Washington as a flight instructor. And I'm working to become an airline pilot, hopefully within the next 6 months or so. So prior to becoming a flight instructor, I was working in the aerospace industry with the government of Washington State, helping small business exporters discover new markets, and realized that I didn't want to continue doing that long term. And so when my wife asked me, you know, what would you want to do if money wasn't an issue, it didn't take me long to say that I wanted to be a pilot. When I was graduating high school in 2006, I really wanted to become a pilot. I thought about a military route, but that didn't seem to make sense for me at the time. And the airline industry itself was suffering, and the incomes were very low. So it just financially, it didn't make sense. So I ended up going a very different route. Now, the airline industries, as many people will know, pilot demand is quite high. So it was seemed like the right time to make that jump, and that it would be a pretty secure move. So when I started flight training, I switched from a salaried position over to become a coffee barista, which the schedule allowed me to flight train about 1 to 2 times per week. And all the money that I was making was going into flight training while my wife supported us financially in other ways. When I set off down this flight training path, my wife and I talked about some of the challenges that we would both incur as a result, you know, financially and time commitment wise. And so there are a number of projects around the house that we would love to undertake if we both had kind of a normal Seattle income. But we're, you know, we've got a list going and we have those on hold for right now. So hoping that within the next, you know, year or so, we can start checking a lot of those projects off our list. So if I could script the rest of my career from this point, having worked in government for a bit, having a master's degree in political economy, I would love to be able to bring all those skills to whatever airline I'm working at, whether that's leadership capacity or in some form of management. But it would be really nice to round out, you know, a piloting career and bring all those experiences together where you're able to contribute to the longevity of the company and help train kind of the next generation of aviators.
That was Adam Kephart, flying planes and honestly doing a whole bunch more if you think about what he said. Outside Seattle, Washington, we do need your help to tell the stories of this economy. So please let us know how things are going at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Chances are good, better than good, honestly, that there's going to be some board game playing in a lot of households over the next couple of weeks. Lots of family, time to kill, you know the drill, right? And you could probably rattle off most of the games that are going to be pulled out of the closet without too much prompting. Monopoly, Scrabble, Taboo. Also, though, Exploding Kittens, Frosthaven, Kingdom Death Monster. Those are just a couple of names on the growing list of games that have raised more than $10 million on the crowdfunding platform Kickstarter. That's money raised to pay for production of those games to get them on your shelves. Tabletop games have been having something of a boom the past couple of years, thanks in part to devoted hobbyists backing new projects by crowdfunding them. Marketplace's Maria Hollenhorst went to a Kickstarter launch party.
Releasing a board game takes people. A lot of people.
My name is Peter Vaughn.
I'm Brad Brooks.
Colorful outfit is?
Peter. Other Peter. Yeah, we call him Blue Peter. Probably doesn't translate to radio, but he's got blue hair.
It does. Blue hair and a multicolored neon suit.
I like colors, and it's the launch day of my Kickstarter, so I thought I would dress up. This is my co-designer, Alex. He's designed Critter Kitchen.
This is just part of the team behind Critter Kitchen. That's critters in a kitchen. The game involves gathering ingredients for meals by moving around little zoo chef tokens. There are characters with punny animal-themed names like Martha Shrewart and Bobcat Flay. It's one of those games with a bunch of little pieces.
Place all the ingredients, spice, and rumor tokens in the draw bag. Choose one player to be the...
It's not exactly my thing. It took a full 7 minutes just to calculate scores.
I doubled this to 8, so that would be 16.
But the 24-ish people that came out tonight seem to be having a good time.
It's end of game scoring. That's just how it always is.
It's like ASMR for nerds.
9, 12.
His words, not mine. We're in the back of a store called Geeky Tees and Games. They sell board games, but also fandom-themed loose-leaf tees.
Some of my favorites are Deadpoolong, House Tigarian, The Brew is Out There.
Eric Eichmeyer is one of Geeky Tees co-owners and said the store's backed around 200 Kickstarter campaigns, plus a few more on competing crowdfunding platforms.
It's an opportunity to have deluxified copies of games, exclusive promos, things of that nature.
Since Kickstarter became a thing a decade ago, with a mission of, quote, bringing creative projects to life, around 40,000 game projects have been funded through the platform. And as a retailer, Eichmeyer said he's more likely to put money behind games from established creators.
I do think that there is space for new creators to successfully crowdfund. That said, it's a lot harder for them to rise above the noise floor because there's large companies who are primarily using Kickstarter as their engine to drive new game sales as compared to somebody with a dream and a computer, right?
Critter Kitchen has raised more than $1 million from 13,000 backers who won't receive the game until December of 2024. The launch campaign was in development for about 8 months before raising a single crowdfunding dollar.
We are hiring out freelance graphic designers, artists, modelers, animators, because crowdfunding demands that it looks really good right out of the gate. So all of a sudden we have to animate a trailer and get that done.
That's Peter Vaughn, one of the Peters we heard from earlier. He's the co-founder of Cardboard Alchemy, the publishing company behind Critter Kitchen. Cardboard Alchemy spent close to $70,000 to run Facebook and Google ads for Critter Kitchen and design merchandise to entice backers to pledge more money.
Because it's a kitchen game, we're making a custom oven mitt with the characters on it.
That is modern crowdfunding. And then there are those people with dreams and a computer.
I've got a game myself. It's called Fear the Kraken, and it's about building a kraken and sinking boats.
That's Alistair Milne. I noticed him standing a bit off to the side of the noisy tables where people were playing Critter Kitchen. He's got a background in fine art and began working on his game, Fear the Kraken, more than 2 decades ago.
Are you still developing it?
No, it's done.
Did you release it?
No, because I have to do the whole Kickstarter thing and I know nothing about it. I've been reading books about crowdfunding, and which are overwhelming. So it's a slow process.
I asked if, given the landscape, he thought someone like him could still be successful through crowdfunding.
Call me in a year. I don't know.
A year. Same time that final copies of Critter Kitchen will be out for delivery. I'm Maria Hollenhorst for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, saw this in the Wall Street Journal. It's data from the Federal Reserve and a nice follow-up, actually, to Savannah's story on stock indexes. More Americans than ever own stocks right now. To be clear, that's owning stock in individual companies directly, as well as indirect ownership through mutual funds and retirement accounts. 58% is the number. That's up from 53% right before the pandemic hit. Lots of reasons. Of course, the pandemic itself, millions of people without much else to do and all that relief money. Also, sharp drops in the cost of actually trading stocks as well. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, and Sean McHenry. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.